Hello everyone, my name is Anne Hollins and I'm the Director of the Australian Institute of Family Studies. Welcome to our fourth webinar in the Families in Focus series. I'd like to start by acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, who are the traditional owners of the land on which I am speaking at the moment, and I would like to pay my respect to their elders, past and present, and also to those of all the lands where you're meeting on today as well, right across Australia and outside of Australia. This Families in Focus month has been a great opportunity for us to hear from some of the keynote speakers who will be presenting at our rescheduled AFES conference, which is now to be held in June 2021, obviously because of the pandemic. Today, we're privileged to have with us Anthony H.A.M., Chief Executive Officer of the Women's Legal Service in Queensland. Angela is a lawyer and an advocate for survivors of domestic and family violence. Over 23 years in the Queensland domestic violence sector, Angela has developed a deep understanding of the issues confronting women who have experienced domestic violence, translating practical legal knowledge and experience into significant law reform, policy, community legal education, and safer client outcomes. As Chief Executive of the Women's Legal Service, Angela guides the Specialist Community Legal Centre to build safer futures for Queensland women and their children, championing frontline operations, external advocacy, client services, and fundraising. In 2019, Angela was awarded an AM in the Australia Day Honours list for her service to victims of domestic and family violence. Angela pre-recorded this presentation last week. It's entitled COVID-19 and its impact on the family violence legal and service system. Please note, some of this material may be distressing for you, and we will be providing some helpline numbers for you at the end of the webinar. After the presentation, we'll move to a live Q&A session with Angela present. You can start thinking now about what questions you might like to ask, and you can post your questions at any time in the questions field on the GoToWebinar platform. We get lots of questions, so please be as succinct as you can in your question. At the end of the presentation, the screen will go black momentarily before then you will see Angela and I return. So don't panic when your screen goes black. So here, please welcome Angela Lynch.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you to AFES for asking me to present today on the issue of COVID-19, domestic violence and solutions from a legal perspective with a focus on family law. My name is Angela Lynch. I am from the Women's Legal Service, and I'd like to begin today by acknowledging and paying respects to the Yagara and Turrbal people, the traditional owners of the land in which I'm presenting today in Brisbane, and all traditional owners from each of your respective locations. And I'd also like to pay respects to the elders, past and present, and emerging leaders, and to all First Nations people participating today in this webinar. So, as has been advised, I am from the Women's Legal Service in Queensland. We are, for those that don't know us, a free legal advice. We provide free legal advice, representation and assistance to approximately 16,000 women a year. We have a statewide domestic violence legal helpline that takes calls throughout the state. We help in areas of domestic violence, family law, child protection, financial abuse and some sexual violence matters. We operate mainly out of Brisbane, but also have a small office at Caboolture, which is in the north side, just outside Brisbane, and at the Gold Coast, which is from the south side. We are very active in community legal education. We try to go out to rural and regional areas in our community education, and also do law reform at a state and national level. This is just really sort of talking a little bit further in relation to the kinds of advices and assistance we provide. You may want to look at that at your own, in your own time. I'm not going to go through that too much. Again, this is just providing a bit of a background and some perspective from where we sit. As I advise, we provide 30,000 services to women. 85% of our matters involve domestic violence, if not more really. 26% of our clients are at risk of homelessness. 32% believe the safety of themselves or their children are at risk right when they call us. And obviously we have issues in relation to low income. 24% of our clients do advise that they do have a disability, and 5% of our clients identify as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. Obviously, the issue of COVID-19 has had an enormous impact on the world and on everybody, and including on workplaces. What was immediately known, however, is that from those who worked in the domestic violence sector, that there was going to be an enormous impact on our clients and their children who are living with domestic violence. The impact has really been so immense, and that's because of those orders to basically stay at home. And for so many of our clients, home is not a safe place. But we knew from our own clients who were telling us, as the restrictions were increasing, they may have been thinking of separating, but they were going to go back into the relationship. Basically, they were going to try to stay within the relationship and come out on the other side when the social restrictions started to ease. And we had clients telling us that. And of course, knowing the dynamics of domestic violence, we knew that that would be happening. So obviously the impact was so immense because of those orders to stay at home and the issues about daily contact with the perpetrator, which may have increased his, it increased his ability to monitor and supervise their activities. There's issues in relation to unemployment. Obviously, when those social restrictions came in, many businesses and many workplaces shut down immediately, and people were placed into unemployment, very, very sadly. This financial stress can exacerbate pre-existing issues of domestic violence and can obviously exacerbate those issues. And that's going to be an ongoing issue, even after the social restrictions ease. There's also, obviously, there's been restrictions on the ability to go out into public spaces and even just to have that kind of contact with other people that provide support or may provide support to a victim of violence, not necessarily not only a domestic violence counsellor or a domestic violence service, but also that kind of interaction that occurs that lifts your spirits, interaction with other mums at school and all those kind of things, mums groups and things like that, that help people get by and sustain their sense of well-being. Obviously, all of those things were cut off after the social restrictions were imposed. What happened is that the United Nations recognise the issue and impact on victims of domestic violence and their children and coined the term shadow pandemic. And you can see the enormous extent of the issue of violence against women across the globe, with the UN Women talking about 243 million women and girls having experienced sexual or physical violence by an intimate partner in the last 12 months. So this is an enormous issue internationally and obviously also domestically. And the UN Secretary General on the 6th of April urged all governments to put women's safety first when they respond to the pandemic, recognising the specific impacts on women who are victims of domestic violence. What occurred was that domestic violence services really got on the front foot in many ways to try to establish and try to draw out what was happening in the homes. There were some worker surveys. This was conducted by the Queensland Domestic Violence Services Network. This is an unpublished survey. It was based on the survey that was conducted by Women's Safety New South Wales. Again, what it was showing, and it consistently has shown down the eastern seaboard by surveys of workers, is an increase in complexity of matters that were coming through, and basically an increase in violence. So you can see by some of those statistics, workers were identifying, there had 36% identified an escalation or a worsening of violence. And this is workers right across the state, Queensland Domestic Violence Services Network, domestic violence services, so they're regional services as well as metro services. You can see that there is, they talk about 42% that there is an increase in client numbers. Some actually said no increase, and again, maybe reflecting the fact that women were finding it difficult to voluntarily engage with services at this time because of increased monitoring. The type of violence they were seeing, 81.3% talked about an escalation of control and manipulation, 49% using COVID as a reason for the abuse, 36% talked about an increase in non-physical abuse. And you can see 19% there talked about visiting emergency departments of hospitals because of injuries sustained by their clients. So their clients were visiting emergency hospitals. So there's also issues and themes in relation to drug and alcohol use and increased drug and alcohol use and increased concern and levels of violence as a result of that. So, and at the same time as these worker surveys were being conducted, the government itself, as reasoning behind quite a large increase in funding to the domestic violence sector, and they came out quite early, the federal government, to make that announcement, and they referred to a 75% increase in Google searches for domestic violence. So what's being shown by this kind of anecdotal evidence is women were seeking different ways of reaching out for assistance because they were locked in the homes and were finding the usual ways and the usual opportunities to be able to reach out to services were not so available. Again, there was a number of increases to helplines. There was also anecdotal evidence. There is a referral there to Act for Kids, saying that they've had an increase in children exposed to DV across Brisbane, Sunshine Coast and Mackay offices. And again, just that reference to the Women's Safety New South Wales survey, which talked about domestic violence services also seeing an increase in complexity and issues of violence in their caseloads. Just recently, the Monash University also released a Victorian worker survey, again and consistently talking about complexity and severity of violence, and also noting the issue of practitioners were struggling working from home, and this was wreaking havoc on actual workers' boundaries and mental health issues. So it's that ongoing issue of, and it has been a theme and a concern that has been voiced by the sector in relation to worker health being isolated themselves, dealing with very complex and very, and dealing with issues of violence and abuse themselves in their own home, and without necessarily that kind of physical support of a workplace around them. So these are the issues that have gone on in the last 3 to 4 months. And obviously, we're waiting to see what the fallout of those issues will be. Some possible reasons when we talk about what do we mean by complex caseload, some things that we can talk about. you can see, and we've mentioned before, the increased access and use of drug and alcohol, complex mental health issues. So coming women and other people coming forward with complex mental health issues and seeking help, women with no incomes, isolation and lack of support, obviously health issues and concerns of increased vulnerability to COVID-19. So the pandemic provided abusers with other means of control. Abusers, domestic violence abusers will use everything in their power to exercise power and control. So in many ways, this is not different behaviour, but it just provided, the pandemic provided such an opportunity and many ways to exercise control, saying that you can't, well, you couldn't leave the house, but sort of saying that you can't leave the house, control and monitoring of her technology and communication devices, limiting contact with families, friends and support and workplace, saying the police won't come, saying the courts are shut, and that he doesn't have to comply with court orders. Basically, you're on your own, was the message that was being given to women in domestic violence situations. In relation to family law and parenting issues, what we saw was an immediate change in relation to the nature of calls that were coming through our helpline. It was wreaking havoc on many parenting agreements, the majority of which involved domestic violence. 50 to 90% of our calls to our statewide domestic violence helpline changed immediately to issues in relation to COVID-19 and parenting. Many were first-time clients. They had not sought assistance from us before, and for a range of complex reasons, of which I may touch on some of those reasons later, many DV victims are sharing the parenting of children with perpetrators. But basically, the COVID-19 just, in many ways, kicked the hornet's nest. And DV victims are used to and will tolerate high levels of bullying and intimidation and controlling behaviour via these shared parenting agreements. But when they sensed their children were in danger because of COVID-19, that's when they sought legal advice. So many of these agreements were not court ordered. They were agreements that had been entered into between the parties themselves. At the same time, the family law courts were also then seeing or experiencing a increase in urgent applications. The family law court said 40% increase in urgent applications relating to parenting were coming through in relation to this period during the pandemic. Urgent applications increased by 23% in the Federal Circuit Court. These are all significant increases in applications to the court. So the court also knew that something was happening as well. So we actually ourselves wrote to the family court. I wrote to the Chief Justice. I've never written to a Chief Justice before, but I did write in this instance and said these were the issues that were coming through. We expected these were the issues that were being experienced throughout the country. And we suggested to the court respectfully that they consider establishing a specific response to this issue, of which they did. And they acted very quickly to respond to these issues. And they established this COVID list, which basically is an urgent hearing where matters are heard within 72 hours. There's less paperwork, so relative to the family court's usual processes, this is less paperwork. It's a national approach and it's all electronic. So for people who are going through this list, they may be in any kind of area in Australia, and then they may be having judges. You could be in Brisbane, but have a judge from Sydney or Melbourne. So they were using their resources at a national level. There has to be able to apply under this list. It still exists. So it's important for people to know this list does exist. There has to be a direct COVID link to what's happening. It has to be urgent and a direct COVID link. So issues around supervised contact issues falling down because of COVID, so contact centres, grandma can't do it anymore, et cetera, et cetera. Cross-border issues about issues of children crossing borders and health concerns in relation to children as well. Another reason is that there has actually been an increased risk of domestic violence or abuse because of COVID. So if you can link in the application that the violence has been exacerbated by COVID because of the shutdown, because of the isolation, because of all of those issues, because the perpetrator may be drinking more or things of that nature, then this list is an option in relation to getting an urgent hearing around, obviously parenting issues. I was very pleased to see that the reasoning from the court came from they established this list and they were very clear it was from a perspective of domestic violence safety and risk mitigation. And I congratulate the court for doing that because these are the clients that need that assistance in relation to, arranging some safe parenting arrangements. This is a waiver, Australian Women Against Violence Association, which is the peak body for violence, women's anti-violence associations in Australia, and Fair Agenda released an important press release on the 7th of May, warning that as the social distancing laws ease, that the issue of domestic violence and risk and things of that nature are not going to ease, and that this is actually quite a dangerous time for women and children who may make the decision now to escape domestic violence. And so that the risk when a perpetrator has had the ultimate levels of control and then the loss of that control has been and can be exacerbated by what has happened in COVID-19, it could be a very dangerous time. And you can see that they've set that out very explicitly and clearly the reasons why it can continue to be a dangerous time over the next few months and up to the next 12 months. In many ways, the pandemic has exacerbated pre-existing issues. It has shone a light on existing systemic weaknesses. For example, when there was such a surge in cases of shared parenting agreements falling down, why are there so many cases of shared parenting despite the existence of domestic violence and abuse? Women were seeking our advice after, and they still always do, often after they've already entered into these equal time and shared time arrangements for kids. The reason that they do that is that because they think that is what the law says, or he says it is the law and they believe it. They themselves internally believe it is fair, or they use it as a mechanism to try to appease him and lower the risk of violence. But what they discover after a period of time is that it generally does not work. There are a lot of difficulties, a lot of opportunities for violence and abuse and control to continue in these arrangements. But it can be extremely difficult to change these arrangements at a later time. And their choices in relation to changing are either going to family dispute resolution, which really relies on him, his goodwill in changing the agreement, or going to court. And often they will not get legal aid support to change such arrangements that have been placed for a period of time. And we're even unsure that the court would make those changes anyway. So they become stuck with these fairly unworkable arrangements that expose children to violence and expose the mother to violence. We can look to AIFE's research in relation to issues of shared parenting and shared parental responsibility, also to look at what occurs in the court system as well in relation to these arrangements and why these arrangements are so prevalent where there is domestic violence, and also for proof that it's not just us that's experiencing this, that is actually also coming out in the research. So what that slide shows is it's orders for shared parental responsibility. And this research looked at pre-reform, which is the 2012 changes to the Family Law Act that prioritised safety, or were supposed to prioritise safety, and compared them to some post-reform court orders. And these are court orders. It's important to know that these orders contained in this sample are orders made by a judge, orders made by consent on a litigation pathway, and orders made purely by consent when litigation hasn't been started. And what you can see is that when there's both family violence and child abuse, 69.9% of matters are still making orders for shared parental responsibility, whether it's either family violence or child abuse. In the post-reform period, 83.7 matters of court orders are still making shared parental responsibility. And when there's neither family violence nor child abuse, 89.9. So there's not much difference between when there's family violence nor child abuse and when there is family violence or child abuse, which I would say is a concern. The next slide talks about actual time. It's an analysis of shared time. And you can see from that slide that shared time orders apply in 10.6% of children in the sample where both family violence and child abuse allegations were raised. They applied to 14.9% where either of these kind of allegations were raised, which I would argue is really quite high, and it applied to 21.7% of matters where none of the allegations were raised. So again, interesting in relation to the kinds of court orders that are being made around shared parenting. This slide sets out the pattern in shared time and shared parental responsibility orders by determination type, so by judge determination or consent after proceedings, and also consent without litigation. So in the judicial determination sample, shared care time is only marginally less where there are allegations of child abuse and family violence. So 7.8% of children are where there are allegations of child abuse and family violence, and 11.4% of matters end up with shared care time when no such allegations. When either of the allegations were raised, shared time applied to 10.6% of children. For consent after proceedings, so consent after litigation was commenced, Shared time outcomes are almost as likely for children in cases involving both allegations of family violence and child abuse, which is 12.4%, as they are for children with no such allegations at 13%. And of most concern are even more likely where either one of these issues, either domestic violence or child abuse, were raised at 15.4%. So you can see that, shared care time where cases of family violence or child abuse were raised in consent after proceedings occurred in 15.4% of matters. The extent of domestic violence in the court, we don't exactly know, but what we do know, it's the overwhelming majority of matters. And we know that because of AIFE's research that's found 85% of matters or parents in their survey reported a history of emotional abuse, 54% reported physical hurt, and 46% reported safety concerns. Family violence or child abuse is present in 70% of matters that are judicially determined, 60% of matters that are consent proceedings where initiated but a trial doesn't occur, and 38% of the cases had four or more risk factors. If you want to see the connection of highly dangerous levels of domestic violence and family law or the family law system, you can look, and I recommend that you refer to the Queensland Domestic Violence Death Review Board annual report. In the annual report of 2017-2018, it talks about and has a list of and prevalence of lethality risk factors taken from intimate partner homicides in Queensland between 2011 and 2017. And what it talks about is child custody and access disputes being noted as 19.2% of those matters. There was a highlighted issue of a child custody and access dispute that is wider than being a family court issued matter. It's wider than that. So it is a dispute that may involve solicitors, the parties themselves, and this would have been, it would come up through the records of the Domestic Violence Death Review Board. Interestingly, for called clients, culturally and linguistically diverse clients, that specific, they have a risk factor of 35.7%. So what that means is in intimate partner homicides involving a called person, on 35.7% of matters, there were custody and access disputes. Again, in the 2018 and 19 annual report, and I haven't gone through this in detail, it compares filicide matters with intimate partner violence, homicide risk factors, and there were notable differences between the filicide and the intimate partner homicide, and there was the existence of custody and access disputes in the filicide matters. Of also particular note is in that in several cases in the latest annual report by the board, the issue of financial dependence and financial abuse was identified as a barrier for leaving, especially in regional areas, with money being tied up in assets, partners having overwhelming control of assets. I'm just throwing that in also as a matter of interest. So why do we have so many, I suppose, of our clients that are in situations of domestic violence and end up with these shared parenting arrangements and basically they're parenting with an abuser? The reality is, and it is a systemic issue, and the systemic issue is wider than the family law courts. The family law system involves mediation services, counselling services, child support agency, legal aid offices. All of that makes up a system and it's wider than the court. But basically, and this is from our perspective, physical violence from our perspective is given precedence over the impact of non-physical forms of violence, despite actually those non-physical forms of violence, coercive and controlling behaviours being some of the most dangerous levels or dangerous indicators of domestic violence risk. So the cause of violence is often seen as relationship conflict, and you will often hear that word all the time in the family law system about conflict rather than violence. And what that does is that it pushes the notion that the violence is caused by the stress of the marriage or the relationship. And it also follows that once the relationship ends, the violence will stop. So there's that belief that once everything, the marriage has ended, the relationship has ended, everything will now be okay from now on. Another cultural systemic issue is that violence against women and violence against children are mutually exclusive, and that you can be a domestic violence perpetrator but still a good dad. And that just ignores a whole range of statistics and impacts on children around domestic violence. I think it's an overall failure of the system to really recognise and respond to perpetrator presentation and tactics, and how they do use children as a means of control and the use and how they use litigation and systems abuse. So there's just generally that kind of lack of recognition of those issues and an overall emphasis on cooperative parenting rather than the prioritisation of safety. And I just brought this out. This is a Guardian article. I actually would really refer people to it if they want to get a sense of how a victim of violence feels when she engages with the family court system. And what she talks about, she, in that article, she escaped after being strangled by him. And basically, he held her life in her in his hands. And we know that that women who are strangled, or people that strangle, or the issue of strangulation is a, you know, the one of the highest risk factors in relation to domestic violence lethality. She ran for her life to a neighbour's house. It was in a rural location, but then she was required to live in close proximity to him, as she described the person who'd nearly killed her, as it wasn't possible at the interim hearing for the judge to consider all of the evidence of the violence. So what she spoke about is that dealing with the court was almost worse than staying. And you can see her her quotes there that I've lifted. It seems being accused of being unsupportive of the children's relationship with their father is given greater weight by court than whether the father has exposed the children to violence. So that overwhelming constant emphasis of cooperative parenting. And it puts the victims in an absolute bind, in an internal dilemma in relation to promoting contact whilst actually trying to keep themselves and their children safe. And I just pulled this quote out as well from the article when she talks about, because it is often unspoken about, children aren't stupid. They are both fluent in the language of love and trust. And despite your best efforts, they are inevitably unsettled when your maternal mouth says one thing, but the fear in your eyes says another. So that's that internal struggle that goes on. And so begins the subtle and largely unacknowledged undermining of the relationship between the victim, parent and child, brought to you by the system that was set up to protect both of them. I'm not going to go into this too much, but it is the issue, and I've referred to some AFES research about this. You know, there is the issue of poor lawyering, because it's such a difficult position to take in relation to both seeking safety, but having to constantly act like a cooperative parent. It requires some very astute lawyering to be able to safely advocate for your client in the court. Unfortunately, there is poor lawyering. Unfortunately, how women come across quite badly in the court is when they have no lawyer, and it's very, very difficult for that, because that internal struggle just plays out in the court and they look histrionic, hysterical, you know, a whole range of negative stereotypes in relation to both trying to keep the kids safe but look like they're a cooperative parent. This is basically what we at Women's Legal Service Queensland have developed. We developed it last year. It's a little bit out of date now, but basically it's about establishing that if we're going to make change, we have to have a DV-informed system. We have to have a DV-informed court. If you have a domestic violence-informed court at every level of and every stage, what you will end up with are safer parenting orders for children and for adult survivors. You will end up with more equitable financial settlements. You will actually end up, if you actually take the dynamics of domestic violence into account and know that it will not end with separation and that will be sustained throughout that child's life, you are going to get more sustainable long-term orders. And you will get ultimately decreased litigation through more specialist, if you have more specialist diversionary programs that resolves disputes that can be done at an earlier stage and are triaged away from the court system if it is possible. And if you have improved case management in the court that limits systems and financial abuse. Again, I'm not going to go into, we sort of provide, that was in 2019, we provide a whole range of different ideas. Some of these are also ideas that at a national level, the Women's Legal Services Australia promote through their five-step plan. I mean, what I specifically wanted to talk about is that we do advocate for a domestic violence death review approach in the family law system so that we can understand domestic violence deaths that occur in this system at a systemic level and actually make recommendations for change in relation to that. And the Queensland Domestic Violence Death Review Board in its last annual report actually made that recommendation as well. We are also advocating with a number of groups, including Women's Legal Services Australia, for the absolute removal of this presumption of equal share parental responsibility that is a danger for women and children living with domestic violence in Australia. I just wanted to also acknowledge that the family law courts have made some positive moves recently, and that that has been supported by the government. Obviously, they established the COVID list. That was they did that, and it was really from a place of reducing violence and risk. Also, they are establishing this the EVIT list, which is a high risk domestic violence pathway, a pilot to take place in Parramatta, Adelaide, and Brisbane. That will be established later in the year. That was a recommendation of Women's Legal Services Australia over a number of years. Ultimately, it was also taken up by the Australian Law Reform Commission as a recommendation. So we applaud the government for their investment in establishing that, and obviously for the family court in taking that forward. The court also is starting a process of introducing some risk screening and triage as well. So these are all things that we have asked for. We acknowledge the complexity in a court environment of doing that. But we do actually have to acknowledge some positive steps have been taken. So thank you for your time today, and I'm happy now to talk further with Anne and obviously to take some questions as well.
Thanks, Angela.
Thank you, Anne.
We're back on. Yes. Thanks so much, Angela, for your presentation. There's an enormous amount of information you've provided in your presentation. I really wish we had the rest of the day to try to digest the various elements here, but of course we've only got another few minutes. Sorry about that. I know that our participants are starting to post some questions up. So while we get more questions up there on the screen, I'd like to ask you if you could briefly mention, you've given us a lot of recommendations of areas that need to be pursued and investigated further and acted on, but what do you think we should be doing right now? Obviously, some of those are longer term projects, but what are the next steps now? What would you like to see happening right now?
I think that one of the main priorities is the removal of the presumption of equal share parental responsibility. That is something that can be done quite quickly. It's legislative change. It has such an impact on victims of domestic violence and children. It exposes so many of our clients and their children to danger, that it is something that should just be acted upon. And it really is above politics. This is about the safety of women, victims of violence and children in Australia. Currently, there's a bill before Parliament by our local member, actually, Mr. Graham Perrott, has put a bill before Parliament. And we would ask all sides of Parliament to act in the interests of children's safety and to support that bill.
Thanks, Angela. I'm going to start going to some questions now. And so this is a very broad question, but maybe something that others are also thinking about. And I'll quote it directly. It's, why are women fundamentally so vulnerable to being abused in spite of being educated and successful in the present day scenario?
I think that women are still socialised to invest a lot in their relationships, and they continue to still, despite obviously being, we have very many accomplished women in our society, women as a whole still lack power in relation to financial power. They still, and economic power, status, and still in relation to education. And just taking the example of law students, I mean, I think more than 50% of law students continue or are women, but in the upper echelons of the law, we can't break through in those in substantive numbers in relation to the upper echelons of the law and partnerships and, you know, judicial appointments and things of that nature. So I think it's just that, and we still have very accomplished women who are professionals, and domestic violence services will talk about this, who are abused. And I think that the extra vulnerability also in relation to having children, anyone who's had children knows the extremely vulnerable position that you're actually in once you actually have children. You've got a young baby, you're pregnant or have a young baby at home. You become, you know, really, really quite dependent on a support system. So I'm sorry, I mean, I'm sort of rambling now, but yeah, there's a range of issues why this still occurs.
And I think you said earlier, Angela, in your presentation that about women tending to prioritise the children as opposed to their own safety once they have the children, and that can become an issue as well in terms of getting caught up in something. I mean, I think for a lot of women, it's hard to believe it's happening to me, actually.
Absolutely. It's like, and it's not like it's, you know, the women are groomed into these relationships. They don't, you know, some do start off, they're just horrible relationships from the beginning. But a lot of these relationships are, they are somebody that you do fall in love with. They have been charming, and they are, you know, they start off as wonderful relationships, and then you're drawn in, and you're actually actively, once you actually become more and more dependent, and they look for that dependence and levels of control, that's when they start to really beef up the issues in relation to abusive tactics.
And if I could just add to that I think goes to what you said earlier about the prioritising physical violence as opposed to other forms such as coercive control. I think that's a real issue for younger women who early in their relationships maybe are not able to identify what's happening to them until, you know, it's that sort of it progresses, and then they're not realising what they're really involved with, because as a social norm we're talking about physical violence all the time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's you are second guessing. It's that gaslighting that does take place. It's not obvious necessarily to you, and you start to second guess, and then you become a little bit you're not quite sure. You don't know if you can talk to anyone about it, and you also you sort of second guess yourself in relation to what is actually occurring, and then by that time, you know, you may well be pregnant, or you may well have joint assets and things of that nature, which then becomes more difficult to start to kind of like, if you are going to separate, it becomes much more difficult to do that, and you've got much more of a commitment to each other financially, and obviously emotionally it becomes difficult to extricate yourself.
Thanks, Angela. I'm going to move to some other questions now. This goes to what are some of the things we can do. So, for example, do you agree that early childhood interventions to help children subjected to abuse is the solution to end domestic violence that they will replicate when they become adults. Another question about kids and is, what do you see as the role of schools and teachers to support children and families? And then how can we hear the voices of children and young people impacted by domestic violence? So a little group there about kids and what we can be doing to help.
I mean, I think that we all have a role to play in our responses, and that schools and education systems and kindergartens, all of those places have are integral to our response and how we can respond. And I'm not it is a complex issue, and those schools are dealing with both parents and can be dealing with both parents. These are complex and difficult issues, but definitely, obviously, the younger that we can intervene, the better it is going to be, because the higher levels of exposure, obviously the impact on very young children of high levels of exposure of domestic violence has such an enormous impact on the growing brain, and we know from research it's absolutely devastating on their life and health, mental health, physical health, a range of things in relation to their to child outcomes. Some of the issues about, I mean, one of the insidious issues about this equal shared parental responsibility is that if an order has been made for equal shared parental responsibility, which we can see was really quite common when there's domestic violence or child abuse, it gives the perpetrator power to say no in relation to children getting counselling. So often children do not get counselling who are have been exposed to domestic violence, basically because the perpetrator has power to say no. And also, it is also the fact that children will often not be able to get counselling because they have such such constant contact with the perpetrator that it could put them in danger if they actually do have counselling.
Yeah. I'm going to go now to kind of the opposite of the first question that I read out to you, and that is, given men are educated and smart these days, why do they still perpetrate violence? We don't need to be focusing on why are women vulnerable. We should be focusing on why do men continue to use violence against women? And I think this is a separate question. How or what can we do to ensure perpetrators are accountable for what they have done?
I'm not an expert in perpetrator tactics or perpetrator presentations, and that could be a whole webinar in itself with experts in that area. But certainly, they obviously get something out of it. It is to their benefit that they obviously can have a relationship with their partner, or what looks like a relationship, or what people would call a relationship. They can get the benefits of a relationship, and they get their needs met. They use their power and control in that relationship in abusive tactics because it actually meets their needs. That's why they do it. I forgot the second part of that. What
it's about how can we ensure that they are accountable for their action?
Well, we need a legal system that makes them accountable. I mean, there's a whole range of what does accountability mean. Accountability can mean down to at a community level. It can mean friends and family pulling abusive tactics or controlling tactics up at a barbecue. It can be down to that kind of level that you need people to start to engage to pull people up around this behaviour. But it's right up to a court level as well that we need the courts to also be accountable. And I suppose what we've spoken about today is the Family Law Court And they often don't see the issue that they're really dealing with domestic violence in the family law court, even though the overwhelming majority of matters are around domestic violence. And so issues of accountability or perpetrator accountability don't really feature in discussions about that court. But why would a perpetrator change if he will be rewarded in that court? So if a perpetrator pursues, you know, children and seeking the, you know, the custody of children, and he's rewarded with that ultimately, why is he ever going to change? So we need sort of at every level, including at the court system level.
Sort of related to that issue, there's a question here about education needed for the court systems around the impacts of violence and parenting alongside legislative changes. So do you think there needs to be more education?
I mean, obviously, I think that training and education is essential, but it's training and education by experts in domestic violence. I do think that there has been over the years lots of training and education around possibly these issues, but I do question perhaps maybe sometimes who they get in to do that, and I would be sort of really advocating for real people who are experts in domestic violence, bringing experts in domestic violence into or providing that training rather than perhaps other people that maybe the system is more comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Especially given its core business for the court.
Core business of the court, but they unfortunately there is a bit of a lack of recognition and also a bit of a lack of recognition that you actually would have expertise around domestic violence and that an expert in domestic violence may be able to bring assistance, bring some real sort of value to the system.
Okay, questions here, Angela, about culturally and linguistically diverse women. How can we ensure called women understand better these new initiatives such as the COVID list? And is there any provision of called specific approaches during all these legal procedures? And a statement, the called community has a big reservation when it comes to legal proceedings.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an enormous issue for the complexity for women from the culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds to take a stand against their perpetrator and to have to assert their rights, I suppose, through a legal system is very difficult. There is nothing specific around the COVID list, around anything specifically around called communities. I mean, obviously, it was set up pretty quickly. It's still in its sort of tentative stages. But these are all important issues around access to justice more broadly for those particularly vulnerable communities. More work does need to be done at a systemic level and in an ongoing way to ensure that these opportunities and options are available. But of course, they can go to community legal centres, women's legal services and other community legal centres that can provide a access point to, you know, looking at options that they might have.
And you would be using interpreters in those centres as required.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So all community legal centres do have access to the telephone interpreter service. And, you know, obviously I would be referring for women who are affected by violence if they could contact, you know, women's legal services around the country and obviously other community legal centres as well. It is a free service and generally those issues, if they are from a culturally and linguistically diverse background and there are issues of violence, their cases will be hopefully prioritised in those when they come to those centres.
On the theme of legal services and legal issues, here's a question. If you had to prioritise the top five legal issues that victims need to know more information about, what would they be?
Well, from a family law perspective, it is that don't enter into shared parenting arrangements or any parenting arrangement with a perpetrator of violence, if at all possible, without getting legal, you know, specialist legal advice, in particular, you know, from a, I would be saying, a women's legal service. That's our specialist approach around domestic violence and family law. So to know that their rights, that they are able to get legal advice before they do that, because that is just so key. It can set them, if they start to enter into those shared parenting laws early, it can set them on a trajectory that is really a little bit of a disaster, and it's you know, and then it's dangerous for them and for their children. Other legal issues? Do you just want general wider than the Family Law Act? You know, it's
well, I think this is for domestic violence victims specifically.
Well, I mean, yeah, specifically. Well, I think that up here in Queensland, since the Hannah Clark and the murder of Hannah Clark and her children, she was a victim of it would seem from the public statements that were made around that case, a victim of quite extensive coercive and controlling behaviour. So that issue about whether coercive and controlling a specific offence should be brought in, we recognise that there are a range of issues around that. But I think up here, I mean, what we've advocated for is a bit of a review of the criminal code as it relates to domestic violence, specifically considering that coercive controlling offence, updating stalking laws. You know, there's some issues around domestic violence protection orders and making decisions that around who is the person most in need of protection. There's a range of sort of different laws that do need a bit of a reconsideration.
So just on that point, we did also have a question about that issue. And so under the current laws, how do you prove the non-physical coercive manipulation?
Yeah, see, that's you can do it with a good lawyer. You're going to be who knows about domestic violence, you're going to be ahead of other people. But that's when it becomes really important that the psychologist and social workers that work in the courts and provide family reports are able to inform the court from a domestic violence perspective about these issues and bring it to the court's attention. So really, basically, you would be using an affidavit that spoke about those issues in a very detailed way. You would then be also hoping that this psychological report that's done, if it's actually domestic violence informed, can pull those issues together in a psychosocial way and provide the evidence to the court around how possibly dangerous this kind of behaviour is, the highly controlling behaviour. But that requires a domestic violence informed court to be doing that, and a level of expertise in those psychosocial reports.
And a lawyer to know to go there.
And a lawyer. So you have to have a number of things in place in relation to making sure that actually all comes together. Yeah. It's difficult. Now, yeah.
It's difficult. Now, we're starting to run out of time. So I know you didn't get to do your top five, but you did give us some legal issues for people to pay attention to. I might just go, if we can, quickly to a couple of other questions while we still have time. Do you have figures specific to children with disability and abuse related to domestic violence? So someone asking about children with disability. You're probably not.
I'm sorry, I don't have that. Yeah, I don't have any of that in the material that I've got. I'm not sure that, if that does exist at all, but I'm sure that maybe a children's service or a children's, maybe AIFS would have some of that material perhaps in the research maybe They've conducted in this area, yeah.
Someone asking about, do we know how many deaths there have been during COVID-19 and how do these impact the reforms given they receive the most media attention?
Well, I think that in May there were 8 women killed in Australia, when the average, if you want an average of women killed, is only 4. Over the last 4 days, we've had 4 quite horrific attacks of women. 2 women have been killed, and 2 more are in hospital. Just overnight in Queensland, there was another horrible matter and of a woman killed and allegedly in front of her 3 children in Rockhampton. So a very sort of somber reminder that the predictions of those experts by the women's violence and women's anti-violence experts may well be coming true in relation to as the social restrictions, at least in the rest of the country, perhaps not in Victoria, are easing, that there's some of these concerns. I've forgotten the second part of the question, Anne, sorry.
Oh, no, it was just about how they might impact the reforms going forward. But I think what you're saying really is that we need to remain vigilant now through this this next period, that it's absolutely not over yet. And it could get worse. Yeah. So I'm going to go to just one final question, and apologies if we haven't got to your question. Sorry, I was just looking at 2 questions at once here. So, I'm interested in this one too. So thank you for the questioner. Can you comment on any gaps in information research that's needed to respond to domestic and family violence situations in this period going forward? Like, what's the missing information that we should be gathering right now? Do we have all the information we need and we're just not acting on it? Or is there more that we should be getting?
Look, I do think we have a lot of information that we're not acting on, and we probably, it's really, you know, listening to the experts, I suppose, in relation to trying to avoid risk and deaths rather than waiting for them to occur and then research about how we should have done something about it. Look, I think that there are a range of gaps. I would refer that person to the annual reports of the Queensland Domestic Violence Death Review Boards identify huge gaps, and also are really interesting for researchers to sort of see, there's statistics in there where they could then sort of pick up some issues and then maybe delve into them a little bit more. Those reports exist in other states as well, so I'd be looking at those reports for more information in relation to research in the future. Yeah.
And I really want to commend you, Angela. I think your presentation today has really highlighted a range of information that is available that needs to be noticed, we need to pay attention to. And I'd like to thank you for the work that you've put into this, and it's been a real honour to be able to get this information from you and your perspectives on how we can move forward. So thank you very much on behalf of all of us. I'm going to now you can see on the screen, everyone, there's some helpline numbers there if you need to contact those. At the end of the webinar, a little survey will pop up. If you could take a couple of minutes just to complete that, we'd be very grateful. As I mentioned at the in my introduction, we've had to postpone our conference. Angela is one of the speakers at our conference next year, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, it will be a session not to be missed. So you can now actually register for that conference, and there'll be much, much more information flowing shortly about the rescheduled AFES conference. Next week, we've got the final 2 webinars in this Families in Focus series in June. We have Jay Weatherall talking about the early childhood system on the 30th, and Kelly Hand from AFES is going to be talking about our new survey, Families in Australia, Life During COVID-19, on the 2nd of July. So don't miss out on those. More details on our website if you want to have a look. So finally, thank you again, Angela. It's been an absolute pleasure and privilege to have you with us today. And to have your presentation, which will be available on our website for those who couldn't join us. We're very, very grateful for you putting the work into it and being with us here today.
Thanks, Anne, and thanks, Aifs. Yep, thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone. Look forward to seeing you on Tuesday with Jay Weatherall. Bye.
Bye.
To entertain the idea that there could be any psycho kind of men.